know a lot of you, I'm scared, you know, equations, complicated math. I dealt with that 25 years ago when I was in college. I had a bachelor in mathematics. But after many years, like, oh, you feel scared, you know? Anyway, first I'll give a brief review of hurricane initialization. I know Chris Snyder did a little bit, and we can skip if you feel you had enough of it. And then I'll mention some hurricane observations and talk about a 4D-bar hurricane approach and a few selected numerical results. Now, hurricane initialization using Bogus vortex, and I'll be just focusing on hurricane initialization. In this talk, I didn't include anything on how we make use of observation to improve environmental flow. Okay. And I'll briefly mention, I thought this is a lecture that we will have a lot of graduate students. So, and I teach, right? So it's kind of formulated in a way that is more fit for graduate students, not for you. So I started with three simple questions. One is, why is Bogus vortex needed? And how is vortex bogusing done? And what is the forecast impact? Now do a brief review of two methods from. So Bogus vortex is an artificial. When we say bogus, we meant it's an artificial initial vortex, which is conceptually correct. Okay, we have to pay attention to these words, and it's specified based on a few available observation parameters and some empirical structure function. And yet, we are ambitious. Our meteorologists are always ambitious, try to get dynamic, physical, or thermodynamic constraint into that. Okay, so all these conflict to each other, you know. We have a little bit of observation because we want to make, although it's artificial, we still want it to be case dependent, meaning have some observational information. And we use some empirical structure, but we also incorporate some dynamic and thermodynamic constraint. So we accommodate, not, you know, for the reasons we don't have a realistic initial vortex observed all variable everywhere, three dimension. So vortex focusing, creation of a bogus vortex, as simple as that. So we switch words, bogusing vortex, vortex bogusing, you know, and things like that. Now conditions, the general conditions for bogus vortex specification. And what we want is there are three conditions. One is the structure of the vortex should be dynamic and thermodynamically consistent. This meant variable balance, you know, between different variables. We want that to be incorporated.
So it means gradient wind balance?
Something like that. And the simplest is gradient wind balance or just geographic wind balance. More complicated can be hurricane model. Yeah, some sort of balance. But this, we meant variable versus variable, meaning wind, and temperature, and which not. Second is the size and intensity of a real tropical cyclone. TC stands for tropical cyclone. Should be represented because real storm evolve in different environmental conditions, okay? And they possess unique size and intensity, okay? Now, when I tried, over the years, I still didn't get an answer. Anybody in the audience know that? What controls the size of a hurricane?
Oh.
And I... I'm still amazed. It's so relevant that when I do, see, we are so much concerned with the intensity, right? And the size of, they are like, the success of the bogus vortex also rely on that. See, you can sometimes bogusing a reasonable size of hurricane into your model, And some maintain that size and evolve, have a good intensity. Some just shrink into a little thing, and you still get the right track, but you don't get the right intensity.
But there's another problem, and that is how do you do the partition? How do you recognize from the environment what is the storm and what's the environment? If you have a storm in a big monsoon trough, it's a little bit tricky to know what is the size of the storm.
Yes, but the thing is, we also find two cases where you had same environment, same geographical location, and one just have the right size, the other don't. You know, it's kind of challenging. Let me stop here. Also, the bulbous vortex is compatible with the resolution and the physics of the prediction model. So you don't experience a too long spin up problem, because that time will add to your forecast error. Okay, that comes back to the same question. Why is the bulbous vortex needed? My opinion is still needed. And there are people at Upper East End that we don't do bulbous, but they, you know, I believe at this moment, depending on your resolution, you see, you may not need a bulbous vortex when you do a large scale hurricane forecast. But if you do very high resolution using large scale, then you want to resolve initial vortex at the model resolution, you may still need the bulbous, you know, to create a finer resolution initial structure. So it's never, you know, it's relative whether it's needed or it's not needed, you know, and I'm not interested in that kind of thing. And also, you know, a lot of time you think, oh, we have so much observation, but a lot of time over times or over areas where you wanted observation, the observation have had a problem. Or had a cloud contamination, had a rain contamination, so a lot of time, you know, you don't really have much observation in hurricane regions, okay? And Chris mentioned the crack location, realistic intensity, and the structure important for hurricane track and intensity forecast. You can do a sensitivity run, changing the location, all these, and you'll prove that easily. Okay, now, how is bulbous vortex bulbousing done? Traditionally, people specify a kind of vortex structure of a single variable, and you can choose tangential wind, you can choose sea level pressure. Why them? Because they have simplistic structure, right? Tangential wind, sea level pressure, they are most, if you treat them symmetric, you know, they are more symmetric than other field, okay? And so it's easier to specify, okay? And then once you specify one variable, you want to derive the other variable, you use simplified dynamic constraint, or simplified model, Bell-Chappell model, QG model, to get what you want. And you can make it as complicated as it goes, okay? Now, I think we can go quickly. I briefly summarized two methods, one at NSEP, one at GFDL. I think more detail than Chris. You want me to skip these review, or we can go? Okay. Okay, what they did is that firstly they specify an empirical surface pressure field, okay, meaning that's the artificial vortex, okay, and once you have surface pressure, then you can derive all the red one out of the field that you needed, okay. So they derive, once you specify this, and then you can derive surface wind, using the gradient wind relation. And once you have that surface wind, you can derive 3D wind using empirical vertical structure function. So empirical structure comes in, okay? And then once you have 3D wind, you use I put here the gradient wind relation again in the 3D space to get 3D wind. And and you get the wind, you go back to use it again to use a variable f, okay? And in the previous step, they use a constant f. You know, you play back and forth with the same constraint gradient wind relation you mentioned. I guess you're not a meteorologist, right?
No.
Yeah, because from the morning's meeting, I think you're a mathematician. And it's amazing you know gradient wind relation.
Thank you very much.
careful who you're dealing with there.
Okay,
come to my talk tomorrow. You'll
okay.
See, I know quite a lot of meteorology.
Okay, no. Then you use the hydrostatic equation to derive from the potential wind, the virtual wind. I love math. So that's what. Okay, relative humidity, they just use a empirical structure, assuming a saturated vortex center and invariable and linear interpolation. Okay, so why? I mean, when you go to the equation, and then it's 10 slides, so good I removed them. So basically, you see the main feature of that, a lot of empirical stuff, and some dynamic constraint, and some, so you see the good part and the weaknesses, so we can go to more advanced methods, okay? Then once you have a specified focus vortex, and this is the large scale analysis, you do a merging of the two fields using a empirical weighting function, which gives more weight to vortex when you go closer to the center, and give more weight when you are away further from the center. Okay, this is the two plots. You see the difference. This is original initial condition large scale analysis. This is prescribed focus vortex. And what's plotted here, I said, if you're familiar with this, one is this potential temperature. Then the dashed is the normal wind component of wind.
What happens if the model has a vortex in the wrong place?
You remove them first.
How do you remove them?
I don't know how they did it. So I know, GFDL used the filter that I'm going to cover later. And in this case, I think it's not strong. So you don't have to worry about that. And if you do have a vortex in the large scale analysis, but in the wrong place, you do have to remove them. But if you do have a vortex in the large scale in the correct position, but not necessarily good, and you don't have to worry about it because the vortex will override them. So this is the forecast, 48-hour forecast with without focusing vortex, and you observe what kind of impact, and what they mentioned is a stronger wind, warmer temperature. This is potential temperature, and a deeper hurricane. Right, it's kind of expected. Even if you don't do vogelsing anyway, you make a longer forecast, you get these. So a lot of time people don't do vogelsing by running a model longer and then snap, get those vortex, pick that, come back and put it in. But it's a cheap bogus vortex. Now, GFDL method, same thing, I have only a few slides for this kind of talk. Okay, what they do is, initialization is done by adding two fields. One is the vogelsing, the other one is environmental flow. No, the environmental flow is the original large scale analysis with the vortex removed. So it's completely the environmental flow without vortex component. And then you add a vortex, specified vortex. Procedure, and what they do is obtain the environmental flow field by removing the analyzed tropical cyclone vortex, but they do keep one information, remove that, they get that information. And then the field, the one variable they specify in the Bogus vortex is tangential wind. Okay, and then they generate all other model variables using an axis symmetric hurricane prediction model. By running that model, nudging, you know, force the model tangential wind to the specified tangential wind. So after the 1 day, 2 day forecast at the end, you get every vortex field. Okay, that's, so normally I think 80% of their improvement, 90% is done by then. But to be more ambitious, you can continue that you want to obtain an asymmetric component of wind. Okay. In fact, when you run, since this is a model, axis symmetric, if you run a hurricane model which is not axis symmetric, you'll get the asymmetric component. But since they use this model, so what they do is they integrate a simplified barotropic vorticity model to get the asymmetric component. Okay. And
you have to do that, presumably, each time.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do that at each time, because the vortex, the Bogus vortex, will be a vertical structure.
Yes,
so
but this is multi-level model. They use you know, the bar-
you do that at each level.
Yes, they use that nudging the tangential wind, and what the asymmetry they got is mainly due to beta effect. You know, the advection of the asymmetrical wind produce advection of symmetrical wind produce asymmetry. So yeah.
According to the our analysis, the asymmetries that come from the background shear and the ones that come from asymmetric source drums, that, for example, the ATP release, are
uh-huh.
at least as important as the beta effect.
Yes,
so
but in this,
yeah,
I'll talk about that later. But in this method, when they use the barotropic vorticity model and the latent heat I-betic effect is not included.
Barotropic, you said it's multi-layer.
This is a bar- I think it's a barotropic vorticity equation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
So only take care of one course of the asymmetric component.
Okay.
Then, of course, they since you have a different wind, so they readjust the mass field, because mass field is symmetric by using a divergence equation. But when you go to the actual procedure, you see there's a lot of ad hoc approximation there, because it's not a unique one-to-one equation. So mainly like a 60% empirical procedure. So it's a good exercise to do that. And this is only one plot I show the impact. And that's exciting, right? If you anything you try give you this much improvement, that's good, whether you did good or bad. This is the forecast with the vortex bogusing and the track arrow, and this is the NHC, so it's much better, but I don't see any line that compared to say other Bogus vortex, but still pretty good if you're talking about 3 day forecast, 100 kilometer track arrow, and then still good, right? Even now, like many years now. Okay, we come to the second part of my talk is hurricane observations. Besides hurricane like picture, you know, everybody see those satellite picture. How many observations have you seen like within hurricane? Whether it's a profile, whether it's a horizontal distribution? No, right?
You're asking a general question?
Have you seen other hurricane observation, meaning observation over hurricane region besides that satellite picture?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there are a lot of observations there, but many of them, just when you really want to make use of them, it represents so much challenge. idea. Those are six we are working with radiances. So that include infrared and microwave radiances. And so a lot of radiances, if you say go look at the ARs and infrared radiance, and then over hurricane region, you'd have a data void because of the cloud contamination. Okay, but today I'll mention some results that we use microwave radiance, and you do can see through the cloud. Radar data, that's good data, but very challenging to use it because the radar what radar resolves and observes, what model can predict now, they are just, see if the model, the observation tell this is the inflow radio wind, it's blue, the model when you map it, you see it's red, it's outflow. So it's just day and night, you know, the model is still not there. And also hurricane is large, if you deal with one radar, you cover only part of hurricane. So basically you have to worry about how are you going to modify the entire hurricane and stuff like that. So, but they do give you a lot of good information, reflectivity and radio velocity at a very high resolution. So when you deal with this radar data, you have to do probably do super ops, meaning averaging these data before you make use of them and or do something else. And Tom's ozone ozone contain a lot of hurricane information. Now I'm going to show you some, because ozone basically, ozone rich region is in the stratosphere, right? And the hurricane, you know, push the chopper push up and down, and everything where you see that in ozone, you know, it's a very nice hurricane structure there. So a lot of observation we can see hurricane, you know, below or sea level pressure. This will tell you what the top of the hurricane should look like, you know. So I thought it's a very good data source. And Jochensen and TJS, they are very similar. So both of them give you vertical profile, okay. And these two give you horizontal structure, okay. And the quick scale give you surface wind. And all of them are very attractive for us to use them to improve hurricane initialization, but all of them have their own challenges. And say quick sketch, you know, it's a surface wind. And how are you going to make that surface wind to influence upper level? Second, most of the time when the surface wind exceed 20 meters per second, they are not any of any good quality, and that's where we want to use the data, you know. So it's the rain contamination. So different observations give you different information, and none of them give you everything, okay? So, and none of them is easy to assimilate or to construct a structure. So the art of hurricane initialization is to make an intelligent use of these different data and combine it with the traditional method. So maybe we can alleviate some of the ad hoc thing that we had to do without data. Okay, give you one example. This is Hurricane Barney. At this time, I indicate, so this is SSMI observed radiance at high 85 gigahertz channel, and this channel observation is supposed to be sensitive to the ice. Okay, and particle, this is model. So, what you see is that, wow, when we first did that, we said, oh, there's no way we can use this data. The observation, you know, even if you don't do precise location difference, then the difference is about 40 degrees. But if you do, like, correct exactly the difference between the two fields at the same grid, the difference can be as high as 100 degrees. And at this point, we stopped even dreaming about making use of these data. We have to think, something could be wrong with the model or with the radiative transfer model. So this is, sometimes we have to deal with, so this is my PhD, one of my PhD students' work. And so what we did is we went back to check the radiative transfer model and the microfluidics scheme used in the MM5. And then we have to make the consistent, because a lot of time, like job size distribution, interception, all these, the radiative transfer model doesn't necessarily agree with what's specified in the microfluidics. And so we have to do a lot of checking and tuning. And then what we get is this figure. Let's see why. Okay, yeah, the middle one is observation, and the color is completely changed here than here. Okay, now, so now these are four different microfluidic schemes, and all these four had a grandpoint as a prognostic variable, but the rising one does not have. But basically, these four on the side are the model simulated radiance, and that's the observation. And the difference now, after all those modifications, everything consistent is less than 20 degrees. And that's
Shelly, can you say a little bit more about exactly what the difference between the original model results and these model results?
Okay, let's go back.
I mean, you say you went back and checked radio transfer, microphysics?
Yes. Yeah, but I listed there, but I didn't go one by one. But this is not responding.
It's not a big deal.
Okay. So the one major one, in the original radio transfer model, the ice particle and the air had been considered homogeneous. And also, they are treated as spherical shape, because in the dielectric constant, your shape constant is different for different shape, you know. So originally, we had these kind of crude approximation, and the volume of mix was considered as solid sphere. Okay. Then we modify in the modified version that I showed in the next slides. We use the Maxwell Garnett mixing formula, which means that we treat the ice not as a spheric solid and not a homogeneous mixture between air and ice. And so, but this formula is not new. It's used by radar meteorologists. Okay, so we use this, and also the job size distribution, the interception, and not, you know, was specified differently in the model. This is input parameter for microfluidic scheme, for radiative transfer model. So we made this same, and also the density of the hydromedium. They are input constants, so make them same. I think those three changes. This is another observation, and ozone distribution, so this is the column integrated ozone. So you see hurricane here, right? See a lot of feature that you see in, say, satellite picture, in the cloud, the center, and the rain band, right, and the general size. Okay, so there is a ozone high here, and the low ozone here, and the high around. Okay, so this is basically a refreshing, you know, when you have convection, you push the triple poles high, and so the vertically integrated ozone layer is shallower. Okay, so you have low here, but in the hurricane eye, for strong hurricane, you have a little bit downward tip, you know, downward motion, so you can find. But if you, this is the raw data, okay.
So is each one a pixel? Is each one of these little regions a pixel?
Is this parts per million?
What's the resolution?
This ozone the routine is around 25 kilometers.
Is this parts per million?
Yes.
It's a nice, I mean,
yeah.
This is
so
consistent with the idea that the eye acts like a very nice little containment vessel in the upper troposphere because the ozone is
but
basically coming down from the stratosphere.
This is the raw data. Level 2 raw data, but if you use their process, their level 3, you don't see this center.
Oh, you don't?
It's smoothed out.
Oh.
So in the hurricane, it's just a low, big low.
Don't smooth it. This is, nice, actually. This is useful.
But when you deal with data, you get so scared, you know. And you, this data we got from 5 years ago from NASA, right? And they improved their retrieval algorithm and they reprocessed the data. And in their new data, I don't see that structure. And you keep emailing them, asking what happened, and nobody responds, you know. So it's scary.
We're
know?
Going to Mars, haven't you heard? We're going to Mars, haven't you heard?
Okay.
Anyway. So, just give you some comparison that I got excited with. This is the same time, sea level pressure, geopotential height at 340 K, and tons of ozone is one level, so you don't have to specify level, and it's column integrated. So at different time when the tropical, this is a hurricane Aaron, I think, at different time. So when it's just a tropical depression, tropical storm, and then in time it developed into hurricane category 3. When you see these are the analysis, okay? And what you see is very early, even in tropical depression, there's a strong signature here in terms of ozone.
Oh, this is very interesting, actually.
And that got me very excited when I see, and I checked many hurricanes. So you see, a lot of time when you see low level, you know, it's kind of, when we talk about hurricane genesis, you know, right? I say, make use of TOPS ozone data because it's there, the signature.
So how would we call? I'd love to get a hold of this data. This is fantastic.
But the new data may not have that.
Oh, no, raw data. No tricks. No tricks, but it's new data.
Okay, I'll send you some old data that we still love. Okay, now.
How long before do you see the storm in other fields? Do you see it in the outside?
Excellent question.
How long before? So how long in advance would you see it in ozone before you would?
I think well, at least a day or something.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
So it should be interesting to the dynamic. Okay, now. For me, because we want to make use of ozone to improve prediction, so I need to link ozone with model variable, okay? And the model I'm using don't have ozone prognostic variable, so what we want, I'm thinking is a shortcut, is to do some linear regression. So this is a plot which contains a lot of data, so that this is the only plot that slow my presentation. Okay, the y-axis is geopotential height at 340 K, and this is Tom's ozone, and it contains all the 12 hurricanes we can find, because ozone, in the ozone, only you can have ozone data once a day. And also, ozone data are available locally at noon. Okay, so basically, it's a swath. You have to find those cases which sit in the nicely in the ozone swath. So that's why we searched 3 years, we found 12 good cases where they overlap, meaning hurricane and ozone. And we put all the data here. You like this picture? I love it. Okay, now. It's a mess, but you see some structure there. It's not a completely, a complete mess, right? You see these nice kind of wing, okay? So we said, okay, it's not a complete mess. Yes, it's not linear, completely linear relationship. So what we did is that we tried many things. So to illustrate, this is simpler as the previous one, but I just did a line instead of a lot of dots. This is like radio profile, radio mean, and so you divide the hurricane into different interval radio mean. So that's the 12 hurricanes that I listed here, and all the dates where I find the Tom's ozone data. So it's here. So basically, I think it's how many profiles? 30 profiles there. You can count the dates here. Okay, sometimes I count 29, sometimes 30. So 29 or 30. What we found is we can squeeze them together by subtracting the daily mean. So now it's a very good relationship. So what we did, this plot versus the previous one, is subtracting the daily mean. And then you get a very nice correlation.
What I'm a little, what does radial mean, GHT 340 Kelvin mean, when the number's negative there, minus 500?
Oh, radial mean, it's like in hurricane, say this is a hurricane center, you have ozone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You have your potential data.
Yeah.
Gradient.
Yeah.
And so in this big picture, I put all the data on that. Then I say, oh, that's too much to see. So I divide this into little.
So you're doing azimuthal averages at constant radii.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So
that's,
it's the mean in this ring, mean in this ring. Then you get a radial profile just to see what can we do. Okay, so then we can develop a model which links your potential height to the observed ozone, but we had to subtract the daily mean. So then you get a very, very good correlation. And this will be used to improve the hurricane bogusing, meaning that you can specify, at least you'll get the good upper level tropical distribution of bogusing. How much time?
So this gives you a head start in a way.
Yeah.
Because before you have the P3s out and the Gulfstream 4 out, sampling the kinematics and doing the drop zones, you actually have a head start in terms of what you can see from the satellite. It's kind of like a sophisticated water vapor channel, but you've got the ozone channel, so it gives you a head start. That's very, very interesting.
Okay. So this is what we did, and this is a large-scale analysis. For this exam, we did many examples, and this is a pumped ozone, and this is after we merged analysis with that ozone data using that linear regression model. So this is will be our initial context.
So Shala, you're saying you basically use the ozone, this ozone to potential height relationship to provide. Effectively to provide geopotential height observations.
Yes, we also do two PBU, they are all related. So basically tropopause, to define the vortex tropopause.
Uh-huh. Have you tried looking at the monsoon trough in Comet Ozone, things like that?
No, yeah, we did a mid-latitude cycle. that's 2001. So that should be, I think there are a lot of information. Okay, now the main challenge is I don't have time to go over every observation, I just picked two. So radiances, a lot of time you have large model observation differences, especially those channels which are sensitive to hydromedia. And then for infrared, you have to deal with cloud contamination. How do you deal with those data? And one of my graduate students did is that you see at operational center when they do AOS assimilation, they remove any data which had a cloud, But what we found he did is that you can still make use of those channels where their weighting function is above the cloud height, because those are the places where the radiance is most sensitive and it's not really affected by cloud. Then we can increase a lot of used data, increase that percentage from 12 to maybe 60%, So you don't have to throw away a lot of good data. So there are a lot of work. See, data estimation has to be concerned with so many things, and a lot of time before we actually put the data into the model, 5 years gone, we already did a lot of work, quality control, model verification, and fix the forward model. When everything's ready, then it's 3 years or 4 years gone. So a lot of little detail that are very too little data within one hurricane. Okay, see, even though say Taiwan launched 6 satellite Cosmic, have you heard that? A lot of radio sound, but when you really look for one time within hurricane, you don't get many, one or two. So, and if you directly assimilate them, you probably get no impact. I think Qin Yonghuang gave a talk last week in our department and talking about GPSA. In the end, he said, okay, then all we hear is no impact. You know, why do you do all these exercises? But you should, I told the student, I said, even if he didn't degrade the model, it's already a success, you know. But what we think is that not like you use the GPS blindly, because GPS gives you a very fine vertical resolution for hurricane. What you do is you probably put all the GPS within hurricane at different quadrant, different radians together to generate a GPS bogus vortex, okay, with different category, with different longitude, all these, then you can improve our understanding of that. So how do you use data represents a little, a lot of challenge, because they have advantages, because this will give you those vertical structure or variability you never know before, because there's no such observation that will give you, and no such model that will give you that kind of vertical variability. And radar data is a challenge, how to use that. And I think before you can make good use of radar data, we have to make good use of other data, which has like a 10 or 20, 30 kilometer resolution, so you do a real good mesoscale vortex initialization before you then do the radar. Otherwise, it's almost like you perturb the model, and then the model forgets after you make 2 or 3 hour forecast.
Correct.
And Jokunsan, only available below the flight level, and also not available when the weather is not bad. You don't fly there, and GPS has no such problem. And the quick set, the main problem is the rain contamination.
Where's the Aerosonde?
Similar to Jokunsan, right?
What's that?
Is it similar? You get a profile.
Oh, I'm just wondering where one of our colleagues' Aerosonde is.
Should be there,
list.
Yeah. It's not a complete list. Is that so instead of gradient wind balance, we basically impose a forecast model constraint. So the model will so automatically, because traditional vortex bulbs have no diabetic effect, it's hard to improve them, and this way you have those incorporated. So what we did is the same thing, and we specify sea level pressure, and then we do the 4D variational, and we get every model variable. And now the question is, why SLV? We try, you know, and sea level pressure is the one that I said try first. But, you know, having this system, we can try any variable. What we found is sea level pressure is the only variable you can spin up a nice vortex structure of every model field, not others. You can simulate Rankine wind vortex. The sea level pressure does not fit to that. You know, it's kind of a monster that it's hard to change. Anyway. So what we did is that on this slide, I combined several studies. So sea level pressure is specified using the Fujita formula, nothing new. And here there's some parameter you have to input. So basically, central sea level pressure, the pressure at the almost close us bar, and the region where you do both vortex, the radians, are all provided by the National Hurricane Tropical Prediction Center. And there's one parameter are not here, that if you take the derivative of that, you'll see that R naught is the radius at which the sea level pressure radial profile has the maximum gradient divided by square root of 2. Now, so this parameter is not anywhere provided, but in the TPC parameter, we do have a lot of radians, maximum wind radians, 34 knot wind, 15 knot wind, and the other, maybe 24, I forgot, three wind radians. So we do have a lot of radians, but this one, what we did is that we tried hundreds of hurricanes to seek a relationship between this, the R naught with all these observed radians, maximum wind, everything, and what we found is this is a good radiance that has a linear relationship with that. Not the 15th knot wind, not the lower wind, why? This is a model, you know, you see R naught and R 34 knot.
So your question is that after looking at 100 storms, mm-hmm. you did a regression fit for the R naught is the outer, or is the radius of maximum?
I naught is reflects the size in the sea level pressure radial profile. You see, it's this R naught. See, if you have R naught equal 50, the profile looks like that. So this is the place where the gradient is maximum.
Maximum. Okay, fine.
And this is the same thing. So basically, it controls the size of the vortex bogus.
Okay. So
and the wind. And you would think that, you know, this R max may be the good parameter, and it's not. Because R max, maximum wind, are too random. You know, they vary too much. The 34 knot is good because, you know, if it's high wind, the model don't necessarily produce that strong wind. So the 35 knot wind is the best radiance, I think, in all these TPC parameters to describe the hurricane size. You can apply to any other application when you deal with hurricane size, the radiance of 34 knot wind is pretty good. 5 minutes. Okay, we can stop anytime.
So, did you ask us why 35 knot wind radius should be the right parameter?
Yes. You know?
I don't.
Okay, and these are the 17 cases we tried, and then later we did more cases, and it's pretty comfortable with this.
So these data you use the reconnaissance data?
34 knot wind, yes.
That from the reconnaissance data?
For the for this, I don't. These are the model.
Oh, that's the
forecast model. So you can have everything. Okay, now numerical result, impact, I'll go fast. So I share with you two. One is after applying a 4D vortex Bogosing. For the Bogosing, should we put 2S or 1S? I see you put SS. And
I don't think Bogosing
is even
so
oh gosh, I say I put only 1S and the Chris put 2S and I don't know which one is correct.
Doesn't matter, it's bogus.
This is a hurricane case and I just show you, and this is observed check. Our initialization time is here, and basically this is the time when the hurricane is reached the good intensity, category 3. So it's easier, so we take easy case. It's easier to initialize a board using 4DBA to a strong hurricane than weak, because the signature is stronger. So sometimes, but it's hard to make an intensity forecast if you don't use a 4DBA. And we did a pretty good job. So we had observed radius 34 knot, 255, using our regression model, we get INOX 93, and we did a forecast. So this is the one I'm going to show, and of course for the thesis, and this is another graduate student work, and the journal paper, we also made comparison if we just naively use INOX as a radius of maximum wind, and also there's a Holland's formula, which in 1982, which is supposedly better than Fujita because it used more Jochensen observations. And we also curious to see what results. Okay.
That's infinite autistic gradients.
But sometimes the good things don't necessarily bring you good results, because you see, if you have one good, one bad, you get bad result. But if you're negative, negative, you sometimes get the good result. Because negative, negative, positive. Anyway, now, this is the large scale analysis. I don't have many minutes. So just look at this is what we put. And this is Holland's formula. This is maximum wind, and this is our vortex. And this is a wind increment after you finish that. So it's a nice structured zonal wind and meridional wind at low level. So basically you can imagine a low level convergence, right?
This was for you.
Huh?
This is your thing. This is your model.
This is the field after you do the vortex minus the analysis. So it's an increment. That is dynamically model consistent with the sea level pressure.
This is a wave number one asymmetry that you're adding back into the Bogus vortex.
Yes.
Is that what you do?
No, no, no. This is generated by model. But it's what you see. This you can, if you're familiar with the OI. Normally you get this kind of structure, but not rotated, like just straight. This axis should be here, based on the geostrophic balance. If your analysis include that, but this is a nonlinear model, so you have this axis tilted.
Do you use any constraint here that you know the speed and direction of the analysis time?
The constraint is the specified signal.
Yeah,
model.
But in your bogusing, do you use anywhere the constraint that you know in which direction the storm is going at time t equals zero? And then
no.
You know the direction.
No, not direction, the location we do use.
It's basically that constrains the asymmetry.
Okay, so we'll go fast, and I don't think I have time. Anyway, this is the increment of pressure. You have a low here, the dark end, the wind, you have a warm core here, and I plotted every time step, so you can see the evolution. But these two fields are kind of boring, but you do see interesting features here in the divergence field, okay, and hurricane initialization. You see the red is the divergence, blue is the convergence. This is at the end of a simulation window. This is at the beginning of estimation window, and the red, blue are just reversed. And so basically, if you force the model to generate a strong low, what the model at initially, what it can only do is hydrostatic balance. Okay, so you push the air down, so you get those kind of things. Okay, so once you have a low, then the dynamic, this is at the initial time, hydrostatic balance. And at the end of a simulation window, the dynamic balance dominates. Because once you have a low, then you know all these dynamic balance appears that you have latent heat and low level convergence. I have only 2 minutes or 1 minute? No minute. Okay, so this is the check and intensity forecast. So the black is observed track, the blue is the one that I described today. You can ignore other fields. And the track arrow is within 100 kilometers, and this is the intensity. The central sea level pressure, this is observed, this is predicted, and the low level maximum wind. Now we'll jump to, this is another hurricane we tried, and the pink line here is the observed track, and this is modeled. So it's looped every time step. And the thing is, you can, we even simulated this turning at the end, if you look carefully. And this is a pretty good case that it does not shrink to a little thing that is pitiful. So, okay, I'll skip this simulation result of satellite radiance. Then we jump to the conclusion. I should have skipped those reviews.